This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers. Welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. This is your HedgeGhoul Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. Now, in our last podcast, we looked at North Wicklow in the revolutionary decade. And for this one, we turn our attention to the south of the county. And I'm joined by local historians, all of whom have articles on the Wicklow Heritage website, which I highly recommend. From Ashford, we have Sheila Clark. From Wicklow Town, Brendan Flynn. From Arklow, Jim Rees, from Carnew, Kevin Lee. And we're also joined by a regular HedgeGhoul participant and contributor to the magazine, Pádraig Óg O'Rourke. And this podcast is supported by the Commemorations Unit of the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht and Media, and Wicklow County Council's Archives Service. Okay, Jim Rees, just to get us started, Jim. Now, last week, we looked at the north of the county. Tourism was a big part of the economy. The population of Bray, for example, apparently doubled in the summertime. What was the situation in the south of the county? Just give us a sketch of what type of society was it? What sort of economic activity was going on? Jim?
Yeah, well, actually, particularly in the southeast of the county, around Arklow itself, there was quite a diverse range of economic activity. Probably the most important, or one of the traditionally the most important, would have been the fishing. We had quite a sizable fishing fleet here. And even, say, up to about 1900, in the early years of the 1900s, we could have been described as the Killybegs of the time, or Castletown Bear. It was very important. And was still there as we came into the 20th century. But as well as that, we had a strong trading fleet. The local schooners back and forth across the English Channel and the near continent. We had Parnell quarries out at Arklow Rock, and now that's still there and now run by Roadstone. But most of all, the biggest, we had boat building, of course, as well, John Terrell and Sons, and they had gone into a great deal of innovation in boat design. In fact, in Turles in 1908, the first motorised fishing boat built in Britain or Ireland was launched at John Turles Yard in 1908. But the biggest contributor and the biggest economy of all, or contributor to the economy of all, was Kynoch's munitions factory. And that was a Birmingham factory that had set up an Irish branch here in Arklow in 1895. And that brought in people from Wicklow, Rathdrum, Carnew, Shillelagh, Gorey, down into County Wexford. And so it was a very, very important hub, even before the outbreak of the war, which we'll come to, I'm sure. It had over 1,000 employees. So there was a lot of money circulating in the southeast, particularly at that time.
Okay, so it's not typical then of Southern Ireland, which we think of as, you know, underdeveloped industrially, agriculture. So it's quite an economically advanced region. Is tourism a factor like in the north of County Jim?
Not at this lead in time, not for the first 20 years. It did become more important. When Kynoch's closed, so they had to find something to fill the gap, and attention then was turned on tourism. But for the first 20 years of the 20th century, not a significant thing at all. As you say, it was probably the most industrialised town. Arklow was probably the most industrialised town of its size in the country. And the rest of the area were able to feed off that to a certain extent.
And I'm presuming then the rest of the county then is, you know, there's agriculture, hill farming is important throughout the whole county. Now, I just want to move on to Kevin Lee, Kevin, because in the last HedgeGhoul, one of the features we looked at was the fact that outside of Ulster, probably Wicklow had the highest Protestant population, right? And that had a bearing, and like Greystones, for example, was a majority Protestant town. And as I understand it, that's the situation throughout the county. Now, Kevin, you've done some study of the Fitzwilliam estate and landlord-tenant relations and that whole kind of Catholic-Protestant thing. Could you talk to us a little bit about that, how that changed over the years?
Well, the Culloden estate, the Earl Fitzwilliam Down estate in South Wicklow, was something of an anomaly. When we think of Irish landlord estates, we think of cruel landlords who extorted high rents to live the high life in England. And when people weren't able to pay the rents, they evicted them, and the tenants had to find their way to the local workhouses. The Fitzwilliams were patriarchal, they were sympathetic. They set themselves up as arbiters of disputes, everything from broken marriages to water being diverted. They tried to solve the problem, and they were very, very popular amongst the tenants of South Wicklow. Changes were afoot towards the end of the century. For a start off, most of the earlier agents, such as the Challoners, Robert Senior and Robert Junior, as well as their predecessors, people such as Wainwright and Haig, they had been Yorkshiremen brought over to Ireland. They were apolitical. They set themselves up to run the estate in as efficient a way as possible, and they were generally popular. And tenants, if they had any reason for complaint, to the agent they went, and they generally found a resolution there. In the latter decades of the 19th century, there was a change. People such as Ponsonby, Captain Terence McNeill, and in particular Frank Brooke, who generally came from a unionist background. Brooke was deeply involved with the Orange Order in County Fermanagh, and there was a change.
Is he related to the Brooke brothers? You know, Sir Basil Brooke. Is that the same family?
Yes, indeed. He was a first cousin of Basil okay. Brooke, who was, I think, for maybe something like 30 years, was Prime Minister in Northern Ireland. But Brooke was a strange character. He was very, very popular with the local tenants. He embraced the ideals of the GAA. He provided the sports field in Chilela for the staging of sports events, which were staged under the auspices of the GAA and under GAA rules. You probably know in the early days of the GAA, things like bicycle riding and athletics were very much part and parcel of what the GAA did. It wasn't just the hurling and football. They covered a wide gambit of recreational activity and
the athletics in Gaelic Athletic Association. Kevin, just going to hold you there on the GAA's significance here. I want to go to Pádraig O'Rourke here, Pádraig, because just jumping ahead a little bit to the War of Independence itself, right? This the fact that you had a higher Protestant population in Wicklow, did that affect recruitment to Crown forces in the county?
It did, Tommy, particularly to the RIC during the War of Independence. Now, just to say as well, it's important to mention that there would have been a strong Protestant Republican tradition in Wicklow, obviously, back to 1798, United Irishmen. And during the War of Independence period itself, you've Protestant Republicans from Wicklow, people like Captain Robert Monteith from Newtown Mount Kennedy, Robert Barton, who was a Sinn Féin TD and who held an honorary rank in the IRA. Erskine Childers, of course, would have strong Wicklow connections. And I found another guy called Robert Hempenstall, who was from a Wicklow family. Now, he was in the IRA in Dublin during the War of Independence and was later killed in the Free State Army in the Civil War. But he, of course, is from the same Hempenstall Wicklow family. Even though he's a Republican in the War of Independence, his ancestor would have been Hempenstall, the Walking Gallows, who would be a famous or infamous British officer in 1798. But what I've looked at is recruitment from the spring of 1920 into the Black and Tans and from the summer of 1920 into the auxiliaries. And the idea that all those who joined the Tans and the auxiliaries were all English or they were the scum of English prisons, that's propaganda. About 20% of the Tans and 10% of the auxiliaries were actually Irishmen recruited in Ireland. And what I found was that at least 42 Wicklow men joined the RIC as Black and Tans. A further two Wicklow men, a Richard Kent and a George Lester, who were ex-officers, joined the auxiliary division. And what's interesting is that again, putting paid to this propaganda, 30 of the 44 Wicklow men who joined the Crown Forces, the RIC during that period, were ex-First World War veterans. Now, that wouldn't be unusual for recruitment in black and tans in any Irish county.
Sorry, Paul, can you just stop you there? Because I want to bring in Brendan here, because Brendan doesn't work on the RIC. Because I want to just, Brendan, if I could bring you in there on just, and I'll come back to Paul in a minute on the War of Independence. But before the War of Independence, like in the early 20th century, what was the attitude of the RIC in the county by and large?
I would have said that Wicklow would have been like most other counties in Ireland at the time, perhaps a little bit more on the established side, because of the large towns, as has already been mentioned, Bray and Greystones were big popular resorts for the middle classes. Arklow was a big industrial, if you like, town, and it was like Wicklow was a fishing town. So there was a very strong, let's say, influence by the establishment as a group on the entire eastern seaboard of Wicklow. It didn't have the same influence in the rural areas at all, at all, at all. And when I say rural, I think if you went as far as Roundwood, you're almost out of that coastal seaplain zone where all the middle class is occupied. These to a man supported the establishment. So there would have been pro-police and pro-law and order. A lot of that changed, I have to say, as the War of Independence progressed, a lot of that changed. But at the start of it, that's the way it would have been.
Can I go back to Kevin on this, Kevin? Because you were talking about the GAA there, because it seems to me that the GAA is one of the vectors that leads to this polarisation. If I've got that right, Kevin, just talk to us a little bit about that, because I'm assuming that on the Fitzwilliam estate, that the Fitzwilliam would have been, you know, patronising cricket and various other so-called foreign games and so on, right? So how did that develop then as we get into the early 20th century?
Prior to the close of the century, what people did in their spare time, the type of sports they participated in, what they trained for and so on, was totally dominated by a Fitzwilliam facility at a place called Umrigar, just to the south of Carnew. Here you had a very large viewing stand. You had a horse racing event held five times a year. Not only the point-to-point, the hunter chases, this kind of thing. You had the flat races, you had hurdle races, you had special trains coming from Dublin. But apart from the horse racing activity, you had this playing of cricket and athletics and events there. And the local lads who were later to become prominent in the GAA, people like the Malloys, they rubbed shoulders with the sons of the minor gentry in the area and playing cricket. Actually, the opening batsman for the Carnew cricket team was a guy called Malloy. He later was to become prominent on GAA teams representing Carnew. Now, the club in Carnew, the GAA club in Carnew, was one of the first to be organised in County Wicklow. In 1886, it was formed. It was named after a guy called Cian, who was, I think, he's from Camolin, but he was the insurgent who, in 1798, who had burned or torched Culloden House. So it was obviously...
That's pretty provocative then.
It was provocative. Later they became known as Cruger's Volunteers. Yeah. That was important because a son of Frank Brooks was serving with the British Army in fighting against Cruger in South Africa. And Lord Milton, the later 7th Earl Fitzwilliam, also became very famous as a railway engineer during that war. So it was kind of giving the fingers to Culloden when they called themselves the Cruger's Volunteers. And they moved away from the playing facility at Umrigar, and they acquired a field in a place called Cronyhorn, which was donated by the McRae family. And it was here that they invited teams from all over Ireland, and particularly from Dublin, who came down on the train to play matches in Carnew. And there was a lot of celebration when these matches were being played. You had at least most occasions you had three local bands piping the players onto the field in Cronyhorn. It was a big change from the days when you had the sports field in Umrigar, and you had cricket matches, and you had the military bands, the British military bands coming to play there. Now we had our own bands. You had the Carnoue Brass Band, which was organised by the Pioneer Association. You had the famous, some of you will have heard of Tom Fleming, a well-known activist in Shillelagh. He formed the Shillelagh Pipe Band. You must remember at this stage that musical bands were very, very important. You didn't have what you have nowadays. You didn't have pipe music, or you didn't have records, or you didn't have bands, the country and music bands, the same way as you have now. People, for their entertainment, they like to go out and listen to bands. So you had these martial airs being played by local bands, and people playing what were perceived to be our traditional games of hurling and football in the sports field at the Macrae-owned sports field at Umrigar. So things were changing, and changing rapidly.
Right, just to point out to listeners that gentry patronisation of sport, any sport, was the norm. You've gone right back into the 18th century, even hurling. You know, so yes. I wouldn't be overly present this dichotomy thing. You know, now having said that, though, it's very clear then that the social deference is weakening, if you like. It seems to me. So, Jim, how did this change in attitudes affect, for example, the recruitment of the Irish Volunteers? You know, 1912, 1914 period. How did Wicklow fare there?
Yeah, it was like everywhere else. It was fairly rapid that when the Irish Volunteers started, I think it was November 1913, there was a response right across the county, but particularly down around here, down in the southern end of it, you had branches springing up left, right and centre. And every so often, not only would the major population centres, such as Rathdrum, such as Arklow, not only would they have their own brigades and troops and so on, and groups, they would meet then from across the South County about once a month for manoeuvres and just parades and so on, particularly out around Wooden Bridge, because Wooden Bridge is only 4 miles outside Arklow, but it's also handy for other, for Rathdrum, for Shillelagh, Tinahely, all that area. And there was a far bit quicker response to joining the Irish Volunteers than to, in particularly in the Arklow area, than to joining the army in September of 1914. That was very slow to take off the ground here.
Kind of cut across you there. You mentioned Wooden Bridge, right? And of course, that's where John Redmond made his famous speech.
Exactly.
So, if I understand you right, you seem to be saying that. Redmond's speech didn't have the effect of persuading these fellows to join the British Army.
Actually, it did, but except in Arklow. What happened was there were actually, depending on read the Wicklow newsletter, which was the Unionist paper, or the Wicklow People, which was Nationalist paper, that you get this impression that there was a big congregation of Irish Volunteers out for monthly meetings and parades and whatnot out at Wooden Bridge. And John Redmond, and according to some of the accounts, just happened to be in the area and didn't know about this great gathering. But that's ridiculous. I mean, the position Redmond was in at that time, he would know exactly what gatherings were happening everywhere. He was supposed to be on his way out to his hunting lodge out at Ocafana. And the other accounts say about how it had been all arranged, and he was met by one of the local Irish Volunteer leaders on a white horse, and he was brought down to the field and inspected the Irish Volunteers down there. And then he gave that speech in 1914 at that, saying, look, our fight now is, we do want independence, but our fight now, the common enemy is not the British, our common enemy is Germany. And there was nationwide a massive turnaround to that, and the followers that took up Redmond's advice, and they did join in their droves, but not in the Arklow area. Again, going back to the newspapers of the time, the editors, both Wicklow people and the Wicklow newsletter bemoan the fact there is such a low response. And in fact, a couple of loyalist individuals in the town put up an award of £10 to every Arklow man who recruited for the British Army.
Presumably, Jim, one of the reasons is they all had decent jobs. You know, if what you're saying earlier about this diverse, industrial economy, you know. But listen, can I bring Mary Clark in here, who's been waiting patiently there. Mary, because you've done...
Sheila.
Sorry, Sheila Clark. Sheila. I get my names mixed up here. Sheila, you've done some work on the Somerville estate, like in terms of the First World War British Army recruitment. Talk to us a bit about that.
To join in, basically, with what the other guys, Kevin and Jim, have been saying, the soldiers, I suppose we'll start off with the four Somerville men. Oh, that was quite a number. Four sons joining up for World War One, and they all came from Rathnew. They lived, their home place was Rathnew, County Wicklow. But now the family home was Claremont House in Rathnew, and four of them joined up. Two fellas went first, and the third, and finally the youngest one went. And surprisingly, they all came back. They survived it. They survived the war. And the information I have comes directly from the son of one of those men, Reggie. Reggie was the youngest, and he joined up. He went training in 1915, and off he went then in 1916 to the war.
Now, what sort of people were these, like, in terms of class, background, religion and so on, Sheila?
Oh, well, you can tell straight away they were Church of Ireland, landed gentry, and they lived their lives the way all of the landed gentry and Church of Ireland of that status lived. They lived, they socialised among themselves, they went to church together, and they were homeschooled.
What rank did they have in the army, Sheila?
Well, they all became professional soldiers.
That's amazing that they survived, because the casualty rate amongst, you know, middle-ranking officers was much higher, you know, because they had to lead fellas over the top, you know. So it's a minor miracle that all four of them survived.
Yes. And when you say survived, one of them was a prisoner of war for 4 years. And that was Pat. Pat was caught and he escaped numerous times. So many times they lost track and he escaped, and he was caught and escaped. And finally, the last time he escaped, he made his way out and got away and made his way to London and walked into the war office and said, "Here I am, I've escaped from a prisoner of war camp in Germany." And that's Pat, the third youngest. The youngest one, Bill Somerville, the son of Jim, of Reggie, he said, "My father was affected mentally by that. He used to go into a trance looking out the window for long, long periods of time." We knew that he was, well, obviously now we know about PTSD, don't we? But
Can I bring Jim Rees in here, Jim? Because Arklow then is a particular case where you'd major recruitment into the Royal Navy. Talk to us about that.
That's right. I'm glad you came back on that. I was just going to bring it up because in two ways, Tommy, both the Royal Navy and the Merchant Navy, because Arklow and Ireland was still part of Britain at the time, that even the local trading vessels, the schooners, they were legitimate targets to be attacked by U-boat. And lots of local schooners, small trading ships, were sunk. Lots of guys over in the Maritime Museum in Arklow here, we have lists of the dead, the war dead from at sea. And it's amazing the number. Now, these men never get a mention. And so there was that, but there were also recruitment into the Royal Navy. But I'd say for every Arklow guy who was in the Royal Navy, there were 20 in the Merchant Marine, and they were getting fired at just as much.
Now, in your work, Jim, you also mentioned that the Arklow fishing fleet gets a bit of a hammering from German U-boats. So how serious was that damage?
That was, and it was two things. We're getting it from both sides, really. They're getting direct attack from U-boats, but also their hours at sea and the distance they could leave port under the British wartime regulations at the time, they were very restricted in what they could do. And the Arklow fleet, it was essential for the Arklow fleet to fish not only Arklow waters and County Wicklow or Wexford waters, but they went after the mackerel fishing down off Kinsale from the middle of March until the end of May. They would then chase the herring up the Irish Sea from the beginning of June into August. So they were very, very restricted. They were still able to do some of it, but it wasn't as free and easy as it was, and all the time vulnerable to attack from the German Navy.
Well, that means then, uniquely then, of any region, that ordinary people in their day-to-day lives are directly affected by the war, you know,
yes,
in a way that most people in the country wouldn't be. Now, with the outbreak of the 1916 Rising, I mean, the accepted narrative everywhere else in the country is that this caused a sea change in attitudes. But Jim, I'm assuming that the attitudes of people in Arklow would be somewhat ambivalent to this event, seeing as it would be seen as aiding the enemy, i.e. Imperial Germany.
Exactly, Tommy, you're right. And right into 1917, there were more and more losses of Arklow schooners by German action in 1917 than in some of the previous years. So as the swing towards the Republicans started to move that way in 1917, that was not the case in Arklow. The Republicans here were keeping very, very much below the parapet, because you cannot, there's neighbours of yours that have just been torpedoed and have drowned at sea, or the ships have been shelled. You cannot seem to be siding with Germany, or you cannot be seen to be anti-British at that time. So that was there. There was also a kind of fiscal schizophrenia here, in that, right, people wanted the war, naturally enough, they wanted the war to be finished. But at the same time, there were more wages coming into South Wicklow from Kinnocks than had ever gone in before. There was also other aspects where local ships and local fishing boats, as Kinnocks moved from commercial explosives to munitions for the war, these munitions had to be brought over to Britain. And so local boats were actually used in the, for that purpose. So there was more money. On one level, people wanted the war to end. And another knew that when that ended, the good times were also ended as regards money.
Yeah, but that also means that Arklow was directly plugged into the British war economy through Kinnocks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was very, and in fact, anybody working in Kinnocks at that time were carried an exemption card. There could not be, had enforcement recruitment been introduced, Kinnocks workers were exempt once they carried their card, because they were deemed, it was a reserved occupation. What they were doing in creating the munitions was deemed to be of much more value to the war effort.
And that'd be similar to shipyard workers in Belfast, right?
Yes.
Now, one other factor of this in terms of geography is you're not a million miles away from Enniscorthy, where, of course, there was 1916 activity. Did that have any bearing on people's attitudes in South Wicklow?
A very strange thing happened there. After the Republicans surrendered in Enniscorthy, and one of Enniscorthy's proudest bosses, they lasted longer than anywhere else, they lasted for a week. So when those prisoners were brought to Arklow, and they were kept in the local factory overnight, brick and tile works. And then they were escorted, the following day, they were escorted down to a ship on North Quay here in Arklow to take them to Dublin. They were being taken to Richmond Prison. And there's an account of where, and this is actually in the Bureau of the Military Bureau archives as well, that as the prisoners were being brought down North Quay, groups of Arklow people got around them and cheered them and clapped them, which was kind of out of character. And in fact, in that the Bureau of the Military Archive, they're saying how surprised they were, because in Wexford in general, and Enniscorthy in particular, Arklow was deemed to be a kind of pro-British town because of Kinnocks and everything else. So there was this kind of dichotomy going in. Yes, they were supporting the British war effort, but then there were pockets who were cheering the Republicans from Enniscorthy as well. It's very mixed.
That's interesting, because the accepted narrative in Dublin is that the captured rebels were abused by the crowd and, you know, insulted and so on and so forth. But listen, I just want to move things on, and we'll come back to, oh, by the way, just on Kinnocks, we had an article on that about 20 years ago in History Ireland. Was there a big explosion at some stage in Kinnocks, Jim?
in 1917, and that's an interesting one. If we have time, we can come to it. But there were 27 killed. It happened in the middle of the night. Had it happened during the day, God knows how many would have been killed. Because at that time, for the 4 years of the war, there were 4,000 employees in Kynox. 4,000.
We might leave that, Jim, but we just get the listeners to go onto the History Ireland website and the search engine. So if you just look up Kynox, K-Y-N-O-C-H-S, you'll get chapter and verse on that particular incident. Now, I just want to move on to the 1918 general election. Now, we dealt with this in the last podcast, so I don't go into any great detail here. Two constituencies in Wicklow. West Wicklow was uncontested. Barton was elected unopposed. Then East Wicklow, you had this interesting three-way contest between Sinn Féin, the Irish Parliamentary Party, and the Unionist Party, which, of course, Sinn Féin won. Now, and then in the 1920 local elections, Sinn Féin swept the board, which surprised me in a way because of this, you know, Protestant stroke Unionist element in the county. Any comment on that? You know, why was it that by 1920, Sinn Féin had become the dominant force? Jim, have you any comment on that? Maybe you partially answered that, like that there was this undertow of support for them throughout the period.
Yeah, the undertone was definitely there, but also don't forget the main change in Ireland, the economy was being boosted by the war effort. When the war finished, even before the war finished, as early as March 1918, Kynox announced they were going to have a phased closure of the factory. They knew there was going to be trouble after the war ended. They knew there was going to be a war of independence. There is no way we're leaving the munitions factory anywhere in Ireland and that one in, the one here in Arklow.
So it's a strategic more than an economic decision, if you like.
It is, absolutely. And I think what happened that once the carrot of Kynox wages had disappeared, that Kynox did continue for about 1920. It was closed in phases from 1918 to 1920. But as that economic carrot disappeared, then people became started just come out and became more political on the nationalist side.
Okay, now let's move on to the War of Independence itself. Brendan, can I bring you in then? When did attacks on the RIC begin? Because you painted a picture of a fairly benign attitude to the RIC. So when did that change in Wicklow?
Before I do, might I make a couple of comments?
Yeah, jump in, yeah.
Yeah, if you don't mind, this is to do with what went on earlier. There's a lot of, going back, first of all, to Wooden Bridge, to the meeting there, there's an awful lot of ill-conceived notions about what actually went on there. Not criticising anyone in particular, but the newspapers at the time painted a very different picture. Firstly, what was going on there at the time was an inspection of Irish National Volunteers. They had called an inspection for County Wicklow for that weekend. Now, there were four centres visited the one time, starting with Wooden Bridge. They went from there to Rathdrome, from there to Wicklow. The Wicklow inspection took place in Gunnelly. Later on that week, there were two inspections held in Bray and Greystones. So it was a countywide inspection of National Volunteers. That's what was going on there. Now, Redmond took the opportunity of giving his news at that meeting. The meeting had originally been arranged for the previous week, and if you read the Wicklow People and the Wicklow newsletter of the previous week, it says that they're expecting an important announcement at it. Now, as you probably know, during that week there was a lot of negotiations went on between Redmond and the Prime Minister, the government effectively, in order to get his troops, his National Volunteers, recognised as a unit. The British War Office would not do so because they were afraid of him. And he held out, and when his first statement when he got to Wooden Bridge on the second visit, well, the second week, was that he had two important pieces of information in his pocket. The first one was, of course, the common one that's known, but the second one was that the British government had finally conceded to allow Irish troops be formed in Irish regiments together. That up to that point, up to that week, that had never been done. So that was the principal reason for that meeting, and that's and the delay in it. There was no accident about it. He says, "Oh, I happen to have this," or comments like that. But that was all just stage management by a politician. He arranged the meeting for the previous week, and he delayed it because he hadn't finally got permission from the Prime Minister. And when he visited Woodenridge on that second occasion, the press of half the world were there to watch what was going on because of the announcement that was going to take place. Everyone knew about it.
Right.
That's the first thing. The second thing is just to do with the Navy. I was very interested to hear the comments from Maureen Artram on there about the Navy. He'd know far more about it than I would. But we do have a list of sailors on the Woodenbridge Memorial, and an awful lot of them come from Arklow. If he hasn't seen them, there's a very interesting website in the British Museum, and it includes all the servicemen from Arklow who were in the Royal Naval Reserve. Now, it was a kind of a money thing. If you joined the Army Reserve, like the Army Reserve or Naval Reserve, you were given a basic wage, which was given to you at your as a kind of a stipend, if you like, for being on it. It wasn't very much. But you went up with them for full-time service once a year for a couple of weeks or whatever like that, and you got paid very, very good wages. Now, I looked at the list for Arklow, and there's a hell of a lot of them on it. There must be 60, 80 names at least on the Royal Navy Reserve list. So if you haven't seen it, it's well worth your while looking it up. And seeing it. The only other thing I want to comment on. Sorry, I've lost your train.
No, comment away, Brendan.
No, it's just as I say to you. I think very often the picture is painted. Oh, I know what I wanted to do. You were asking about the change.
Yeah.
In 1918, about what happened. I think personally, this is understated. I think, and no one ever says so. But the two greatest gods in Irish nationalism in 1914 were John Redmond and his brother Willie. They were absolutely idolized by nationalists in Ireland. And in County Wicklow, they were like gods to wear, if you like. Mm. Now, no one ever speaks about this, but the rise in support for, if you like, militant nationalism and the decline of the kind of political nationalism all happened at the same time in late 1918. And as it actually happens, both Redmond brothers died then. So basically, there was a huge vacuum in Irish nationalism, in official nationalism, if you like, political nationalism in County Wicklow, because the two biggest leaders in it, within a month or 6 weeks of one another, both died. And that left the official end of it rudderless, completely rudderless at the time that this other, more militant nationalism was on the rise. And it simply steamrolled it. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but one of the Redmonds, the Redmonds had several sisters who were nuns. And one of them was in the Carmelite convent in Kilcool. So there was and Willie Redmond lived in Delgany. They had a very strong presence in Wicklow and a very strong hold over the older nationalists, if you like. By 1918, there were two things that happened in Wicklow. One is that the leaders of official nationalism had gone, and secondly, that everyone had more money in their pocket between soldiers, sailors, and between workers and Kynocks. I mean, workers in a huge amount of numbers. They were bringing paper from Wicklow and Rathnew and Glenealy, Rathrum, all the way down to and back every day. So huge, but there was money in people's pockets that had never been there before. And that, all of those factors together came together to produce the change that happened in Wicklow in late 1918.
Well, Brendan, that's the irony, isn't it? That sometimes when people, the more money people have in their pockets, the more promiscuous they become politically, if I might use that term, right? It's not necessarily poverty or so on that makes people political. It can be the aspiration to do better.
Yeah, there's also a dependency. In 1914, all workers in Wicklow, all the working classes, would have been dependent on either the upper classes or middle classes for their employment. So to some extent, they were kind of almost told or encouraged in certain political ways. And with the money that they had in 1908, the young lads had in 19, two things that happened in 1918 late. The first was the money that the young lads had in their pocket. And the second thing was the conscription bill was to try to introduce it here. And the big fear there was, one, was everyone in Ireland knew at this stage that if you went away in a uniform, you were killed or maimed, that you'd come back. You might come back with one leg or no legs or in a coffin. Basically, that was it. But also, soldiers were paid a pittance. So it was a very big retrograde economic step. So it's really no wonder why people went for it. It really isn't. I'm not surprised at all why political views in Wicklow changed in 1980. I'm really not. But I do believe that they're the key factors. The money and the Redmond brothers are huge. They're the people who would have kept them in control or kept them back or kept them in tow, and they were gone. So the whole thing was a free-for-all.
Can I bring you back to my initial question then? When then did attitudes to the RAC change?
I'm not terribly sure that they did change. I mean, I've read the County Wicklow reports, RIC reports, from 1914 until the end of 1918. I have a copy of them here. And it was a very, very rural, regular place in the early time. It got quite militant towards the very end of 1918. But at that stage, the police, they had their thumb on what was going on in their own community, really and truly. Don't forget that Wicklow had, I can't remember the exact number, I think 16 or 18 police barracks in the county. They were all over the place. And in each barracks, there were houses attached to it where married policemen lived with their families and single policemen lived in digs. So they were in the heart of all rural communities there were. And most of them were Roman Catholic. So they got on well with people, and they kind of, between them and their wives, they found out everything that was going on. So the biggest change that happened when the police closed down rural barracks, they closed down, I can't remember the exact amount, it's something in the region of mid-teens of police barracks. And from that point on, they surrendered rural Wicklow. And rural Ireland, effectively, because it was happening everywhere, they surrendered that to the local nationalists because they no longer had any power. They no longer knew what was going on, what was going to plan, what was happening. And they knew all those things up to mid-1918. So it was a major change, both locally and politically in Wicklow in late 1918, which changed nationalism in Wicklow very, very dramatically.
Actually, Pádraic O'Rourke, can I bring you in here? Maybe you can help us out then. Let's look at the figures, because I know you're currently reading The Dead of the Irish Revolution by Ewan O'Halpin and Dobby O'Cronon, which will be reviewed in due course in History Ireland, of course. How many were killed in Wicklow? How many of these were RIC constables?
I have their book here, and they give a figure for 11 fatalities in Wicklow between 1917 and 1921. So that's a little bit either side of what's officially the War of Independence.
What does that put Wicklow in the league table, like per capita, killings per capita?
Right, if you're being militant and you're looking at the butcher's bill, as military men would call it, Wicklow is coming right in at the bottom. There are actually very few killings in Wicklow. It is the lowest county in Ireland in terms of fatalities. For example, I was looking at the rates of suicide amongst the RIC in Wicklow, and there were actually as many black and tans killed in Wicklow by their own hand by suicide as were killed by Republicans in both cases too. So Wicklow isn't a very active county, and if we...
Can we speculate as to why they'd all be killing themselves, Pádraic?
Well, obviously, it's part of it, as Sheila mentioned, is PTSD, post-traumatic stress, because whether you're a Wicklow Protestant or an English Catholic who joins as a black and tan, the likelihood is that you're an ex-soldier and you're dealing with the First World War. The other thing is they're paid a very handsome wage, 10 shillings a day for a black and tan, full pound a day for an auxiliary. So drink is very cheap to them. They have a lot of disposable income. And in a lot of cases, drink is free. They just commission it at the point of a revolver, or they run up huge bar bills they don't pay. And then you've also got the psychological pressures of guerrilla war, that even Wicklow, which is a relatively quiet county, you have still the idea of having this unseen enemy that could be the person who served you in the shop, that isn't wearing a uniform. It's a war that these guys aren't used to. They're used to a static war like the First World War and not this guerrilla conflict. And there's two RIC constables, two black and tans, who killed themselves in Wicklow. One is Arthur Hardy. He had been involved in robbing Robert Dixon, who I know was mentioned in the last podcast, who was a Protestant Unionist Justice of the Peace. And he was basically going to face trial for that. And he committed suicide a few days later. It wasn't uncommon for black and tans who were facing discipline to do that. It was just an added pressure on what I've already talked about. And the second one was a guy called Thomas Frederick Aiken. And he was killed himself in Hollywood Barracks in August of 1921. And an interesting note with his case is that he was buried in the local cemetery, and he was actually dug up by the local people that evening, and his coffin was propped outside the graveyard wall with a note pinned with saying, "The will of the people, bury him somewhere else." So it's strange. I've only ever come across one other case like that in all of Ireland, where people would actually try and dig up or remove a body of somebody on the British side who'd been killed and buried locally. But to answer the question, why wasn't Wicklow a more active county?
Hey, Barry, can I just hold you there for a minute? Because I want to come back to you on that, but I want to bring Sheila Clark in here to look at the regular army presence in Wicklow, because there was a regular army presence, Sheila, was it not, in the county? Can you talk to us about that?
In Wicklow Jail, around the War of Independence time, there was the 2nd Battalion Cheshires. And, you know, they covered Ashford and district, and they were very busy people. Those soldiers made up of the army, and some of those were auxiliaries. Some of them, we confuse ourselves between what an auxiliary is and what a black and tan is, but to the ordinary Joe soldier, they are the same. And, yes, I've covered that in the. I went into the military archives and I read down all of the military raids that were carried out by them, and the reports, generally speaking, they reported on the raid. More so, I only came across two reports by the RIC, and a lot of reports written by the officer in charge, lieutenant or captain, on the raid they carried out. So they weren't very popular, they really weren't. And I was wondering, my question was, did the army have, the British army stationed in Wicklow, have more power than the RIC in the local constabulary barracks? Does anybody want to answer that?
Harry, Jim is going to help us out. Jim, come in on that one.
Yeah, just on the situation, again, going back to Arklow and the southeast area, was very heavily garrisoned there's an increase in RAC for a while, but more so by ordinary, regular British troops throughout the First World War period. And mainly, of course, that was to protect the Kynox works. And there's a lot of martial law was introduced in around Arklow, whereby pubs were only allowed to open 4 hours a day. Now, going back to Pádraig's point, that doesn't say that the army or anybody else didn't go in and purchase a few pints with a revolver. But there was that situation. It was very heavily, and one of the reasons put forward to Arklow not being very active during that period, up to 1918, was it was so heavily locked down. Arklow was extremely heavily locked down. And there was also patrol boats in Arklow Bay, again, protecting Kynox.
Could I have my question answered?
Yes. Well, just repeat that question again, Sheila. Yeah. Who was in charge? Pádraig, can you shed any light on that?
Well, officially, I don't think Wicklow was ever put under the same. They would declare counties the British by martial law. And counties like Cork and Clare were put under military law, and there you would have had basically the British Army being in charge of everything that happened. Usually the idea was that ideally that these guys would try and work together, and that the basically the RIC were always to be the first line of defence, because Lloyd George wanted to keep it a police war, and the army were supposed to be kept largely in reserve. But the reality is, by 1920, the RIC aren't really a police force anymore. They're really just, you know, soldiers in policemen's clothing. And really, overall, in terms of the power to just commandeer houses and things like that, or the question of if somebody gets killed in the middle of, shot dead in the middle of Rathdrum, for example, who's in charge of investigating it? Who's in charge of, you know, holding the court of inquiry? It's the military generally that's doing that. So I would say that throughout Ireland, not just in Wicklow, the military have more pull and more sway over the you know, civil matters and military matters, certainly, than the RIC do.
Thank you.
The RIC are the guys pushed to the front for propaganda reasons.
Yeah.
Now, I want to go back to Jim Rees very quickly, Jim, just before I forget it, just on the Kynock story, right? Now,
yeah.
you were saying that it was gradually shut down, basically for strategic rather than economic reasons. But
yeah.
Were their fears ever realised? In other words, did any of the gear ever fall into the hands of the local IRA?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are several accounts of IRA raids where there were several tons of TNT and other explosives were taken out. That's well documented in the military archives. And
just to ask you a technical question, what would TNT be used for? I know it's explosives, right? But precisely what sort of munitions would be manufactured by the IRA? What use would they put the stuff to?
I have to put my hand up here, Tommy, and like you, at the technical side of it, I don't know.
Corey, can you help out here? I mean, large-scale bombs weren't a feature, in spite of Jordan's Michael Collins. The car bomb hadn't yet been invented. But I'm thinking of maybe homemade Mills bombs, that sort of thing.
Yeah, not the car bomb, certainly. But the IRA at this time were trying to use explosives in their mines, and there was an attempt to actually have an ambush with a mine in Wicklow at the very end of the conflict. It didn't come off. If they're manufacturing TNT, I can't claim to be an expert in Kynox, but if they're manufacturing TNT, it's likely stuff like sticks of dynamite, it's gel ignite, it's very high quality explosive. The problem is that if you're not keeping it in perfect conditions, if it gets anyway damp or the nitroglycerine starts weeping, it's exceptionally dangerous. So if you are a layperson who is, you know, engaged in making bombs without any formal military training, you will be much better off with something like going to the Coast Guard station and getting gun cotton, or using something like black powder, gunpowder, than trying to mess around with gel ignite, which makes, for example, the War of Independence, of course, starts with a gel ignite raid in Solihull Beg in Tipperary. And most of that gel ignite is never used. It's left buried in the ground. Because it's dangerous and they don't have the experience to actually, you know, manufacture bombs with it.
That's interesting. So in a way, then, their fears like Kynox maybe were not entirely justified. Porrig, I want to go back to you then on the question, you know, why wasn't Wicklow more active? Because on the face of it, it's perfect territory for, you know, guerrilla warfare terrain.
Yeah, there's a great quote here I found from Gerard O'Sullivan, who would have been a former adjutant general of the IRA. And when he's a general in the Free State Army at the beginning of the Civil War, he says, quote, "There are areas that are now extremely Republican, such as Wicklow, where they have not fired a shot in anger since the days of Michael Dwyer." Now, obviously, he's been partisan in the politics of the Civil War there. It's harsh, but maybe not unduly harsh. Like, obviously, Wicklow, as you said, Tommy, excellent terrain for guerrilla warfare. You go right back to 1580, Fiacc McEwan, the Battle of Glenmalure, 1798, 1805. It's the heart of the United Irishmen's resistance. And that's taken care of in 1798 by building this military road, still there today, and all these barracks along it. And that suppresses the rebels then. But by the time of the War of Independence, most of these barracks are unoccupied. They've been abandoned. Like, for example, Ocavana Barracks, which you mentioned there, was being used as a hunting lodge by John Redmond. And I would put it down to three main factors. The first one was the lack of a very strong Fenian network. Now, obviously, there were Fenians in Wicklow, but they weren't as strong as other areas in the 1860s and 1880s. And what you see is that a lot of the people who become prominent leaders of the IRA in the War of Independence, like Michael Collins from Cork, who's active in Dublin, or Michael Brennan in Clare, is that they come from Irish Republican Brotherhood Fenian families. And that tradition, to me, doesn't seem to be as strong in Wicklow. And the other thing is, regardless of whether they're Fenian or not, it's leadership. You can have perfect terrain for guerrilla warfare, but if you don't have somebody who's, you know, young enough, militant enough, who has nothing to lose, who's reckless enough to come to the fore. Someone like Tom Barry, for example, in Cork, whose father was an RIC man. He's not from a Fenian background, but you need figures like him. And you always get this debate in the War of Independence, why one county is quiet, why one county is active. And people often pick out the terrain. And it's not, because outside of Cork, the largest single ambush of Black and Tans, the most successful ambush outside of Cork, happens at Drumkeen in Limerick. And there's 11 RIC and members of the Black and Tans killed. It's perfectly flat farmland. It's in the middle of the Golden Vale. Terrain isn't a factor there. What is a factor is that they have done up O'Hanigan, who's a very good military leader and who's pushing things. And I think the key reason why Wicklow isn't as active is that even though they have obviously people who are very committed, none of them emerge in that very strong leadership role, the type of person like Michael Collins, Michael Brennan, Tom Barry, or Donacha O'Hanigan. And even though people are very committed, there's just nobody pushing to the fore. And it's only really later, very late in the conflict, that Wicklow gets active. And it's when an outsider, Sean McBride, is foisted in on top of him. But perhaps we'll talk about that later.
I'll maybe let some of the Wicklow people respond to that. Kevin.
Just a quick question for Pádraig there. My main area would be the 19th century, not a War of Independence here, but I've always been puzzled by the amount of burning of barracks and arms raids and so on in Carnew and Tulele here that have been undocumented. To my knowledge, they have been undocumented. I've been through the Military Bureau archive, I've been through the Wicklow newsletter, the Wicklow people, etc. Can't find any record of when the barracks in Carnew. We know it was burned, and we know the British soldiers were billeted in the primary school in Carnew. The Fitzwilliam School was closed and the British Army were brought in and accommodated there. We know the barracks in Tulele was burned. We know it was a fairly successful arms raid for guns and ammunition on the store of Geraghty's in Carnew. But Pádraig, is there a lot of activity that hasn't been documented that we may never find the details? We know we had the Brennan family and the Toole family in Carnew who are very, very active and probably had a role in these events, but it hasn't been documented, hasn't been recorded anywhere. So I'm just wondering, is there a lot of activity there that we do not know about, or we may never know about.
The thing is, you have to remember that the ultimate aim of the Republican, militants at the time is basically to make Ireland ungovernable for the British. And there's things I found doing my PhD, which was on the truce, right up to the evening before the truce. One of the last things that happens is that the postman in Shillela village is held up and his postbag is taken off. And that, of course, it's not as dramatic as the Kilmichael ambush or something you'd seen in the film Michael Collins, but that's a very important thing because it allows the IRA to know who's sending information to the RIC. It is disrupting the normal British governance. People will be out in Wicklow and they would be chopping down trees to fell roads to stop the British forces from moving around. People will be abandoning the burnt RIC barracks, and there's hundreds of them burnt all over the country. But the thing is that the RIC barracks for so long have been a symbol of the British government. Just that arson attack that nobody is killed in, that's not going to make headlines around the world like Terence McSweeney's death and hunger strike. It's still a very important act of resistance. And for those who were involved in it, low-level Wicklow IRA volunteers whose names often are unrecorded or who don't make the national history books, they were still taking very significant risks. They were going out challenging an empire, even if it was something as simple as stealing a policeman's bike, setting fire to an abandoned barracks, or capturing off a train, British Army food supplies and dousing them in paraffin to destroy their edibility or to burn them. Those were still very important acts, even if they're not succeeding in killing people in the British Crown forces. There is still resistance in Wicklow.
Pádraig, just having said that, though, I mean, it'd be unusual for stuff, for instance, even low-level instance like that, not to be documented, because I'm thinking of the military pensions files, that marvellous resource that's been opened up, online digital resource. I mean, my impression was that every single, tree that was cut down or trench that was dug would be mentioned in that archive, because people were looking for pensions essentially out of it. So I'm just going back to Kevin's point, it's a bit of a mystery to me as to why some of the stuff he's mentioned wasn't documented. Any comment on that?
I would say that if we're talking about burnings in April of 1920, everything is burnt on the same night. And something like a courthouse being burnt in neighbouring Carlow might get more attention than an abandoned RIC barracks
right. that
might previously have been a house being burned. If you go through the pension files, you will get those individual incidents. Even things like, I was looking last night at Christopher Burns' Bureau of Military History statement. He was the quartermaster of the East Wicklow Brigade. And he talks in that about, we planned for an ambush, it didn't come off, we got explosives, we made a mine, but the local people saw us, and even the local sawmills closed up because they thought we were going to blow them up or there would be reprisals. So lots of things are planned that don't actually happen, don't come off, and it's hard to record them. Wicklow as well, in terms of there's a Cork fighting story, there's a Kerry fighting story, there's no Wicklow fighting story. You had Republican veterans who wouldn't apply for pensions, and they're obviously not documented, and that was for very ideological reasons. Also, if you look at the Ernie O'Malley military notebooks, he went around and interviewed hundreds of IRA veterans all over the country. He didn't interview a single person from Wicklow. It's just that, you know, he didn't get there, or he didn't have local connections, but certainly there were people involved. And if you just look at the RIC daily reports for, let's say, May, June, July 1920, you'll find things happening like police bicycles stolen, raid on the post, telegraph wires cut. And it's clear that it's IRA volunteers, coming to Mon women, Fianna Éire and scouts, who are doing these things. But because you don't have, as I said, really dramatic events with large loss of life, like the Kilmichael ambush or the Drumkeen ambush or the burning of the customs house happening, it very much gets left in the background because there's more significant things happening elsewhere. That's not to say that nothing was happening in Wicklow.
Sheila Clark, you want to come in on that?
I was picking up on what Patrick said. I, in my contribution, when I was searching the military archives, I came across exactly what he said, tree felling. The locals went out and they fell trees where they could. They tried to slow down the Crossley tenders. And another example of where they went, they stopped the train and they dug up the tracks and they stole the mail bags and things like that. Anything they could. It was, as you said, on a lower scale, but they were active.
That's typical for a lot of counties, not just Wicklow.
Yeah.
Mr. Porry, can I go back to you just to wrap things up here? Because now, just to say, there are plans, incidentally, to do more Wicklow head schools in relation to the Civil War. So we're not going to bring the narrative up that far. But I want to just get an idea of the state of play at the truce. So maybe, Jim, you can come in as well. But maybe Porrick first, because you're making that point about this attempt to kind of rouse Wicklow, if you like, towards the end of the War of Independence. So what was that about?
Yeah, the War of Independence in Wicklow really is a game of two halves. The first half, if you look at the first five killings in Wicklow, Philip Dowling, son of an RIC constable, shot dead in Arklow during a celebration about the release of hunger strikers. Robert Dixon, who we mentioned, he's the judge who's killed by Black and Tans in the burglary. Then you have the Black and Tan who commits suicide, Arthur Harty. Then you have Seamus Jim O'Brien. There's a lovely plaque to him actually right in the middle of Rathdrum. He is killed on the 12th of February 1920, and that was one of the IRA's first attempts in the area to ambush a patrol, and it goes, an RIC patrol, it goes wrong, he's killed. And then the next one, Lawrence O'Brien, who's a labourer who shot dead in Bray by Crown Forces in May of 1921. So up until May of 1921, all the fatalities that happen in Wicklow are by the Crown Forces. And IRA General Headquarters is worried because counties like Clare and Cork that have been very active are suddenly entering stalemate, and Dublin City is coming into trouble. And they say, we need to get something happening in Wicklow. So they send down Sean McBride, son, of course, of the 1916 leader, John McBride and Maud Gonn, and later, of course, Clan Republican. I think he's a Nobel Prize winner at some stage. And there's this quote here from Christopher Byrne, and he says, in the summer of 1921, we were finally getting things into active shape. When Sean McBride arrived, McBride put us in impossible positions, such as taking Avondale House with less than 20 men and 15 rifles and a garrison of less than 300 in the town. He proceeded to arrange ambushes and shooting of policemen, one in each district, for the following Sunday week. There was to be a shooting in every district from Woodenbridge to Greystones. However, the whole thing ended up in the shooting of one policeman. And that policeman was the first member of the Crown Forces killed in Wicklow. That was John Fitzgerald. He was an Irish Black and Tan. He was killed in Wicklow town. Now, he was off duty. He was out swimming with another RIC constable. But again, the rules of war at the time don't say that, you know, if you're off duty or you're unarmed, basically killing is killing in a guerrilla conflict like this, and it's not in breach of the Hague Convention. But basically, this guy arriving down, and he plans all these things, Sean McBride, and as we heard there from Christopher Byrne, most of them don't come off. He planned shootings for every district, every company, and one guy is shot in the end. And his presence, and he's quite young and idealistic, Sean McBride, and his presence at the time annoys the local Republicans. So taking up with Christy Byrne again, he says, Matty O'Brien, who was really in charge, began to growl and alleged that Sean McBride was overriding him. In the role of mediator, I advised him to go to Rathdrum and try to get after the Tans, a big number of whom were knocking about the town, some of many of them. And they agreed on Friday, July 6 to 8, that they would go and shoot one of them. And what happens is a small group of IRA volunteers go into Rathdrum town, and they spot going into a bakery shop near the Fair Green in Rathdrum, some black and tans. And they go in, follow them into the shop, and they assassinate one of them, Frederick Cormer, who's an English black and tan. And he's shot dead on the morning of the 8th of July of 1921. And that's the day that the ceasefire actually is agreed in Dublin. And people often link the two events, and I studied this for my PhD, and they say, oh, he was shot in reaction to it. And this is often used kind of as an insult to Wicklow Republicans, that they only started shooting people at the very end. The reality is it was coincidence. Cormer was actually shot dead several hours before the ceasefire had been agreed, and the ceasefire wouldn't come into effect for several more days. So what's happening really nationally at the War of Independence is the most active counties, Dublin, Tipperary, Cork, Clare, the IRA are really under pressure and things are in a stalemate. And IRA GHQ is trying to ramp up counties in the Midlands, counties in Leinster, counties in Connacht, and places like Wicklow that haven't been as active. They're sending out guys like Sean McBride, and they're just starting to ramp up when the ceasefire happens. And it's unsurprising that many of those areas as well end up being places where anti-treaty republicanism is very strong later.
Well, I tell you, just hold that thought, everybody, including our listeners, because we're going to come back to this at a later stage. Well, listen, I think that's a fascinating discussion, because often the dog that doesn't bark is as interesting as the dog that does, as I think listeners will all agree. I'd like to thank our panel here today, our local historians, Sheila Clark of Ashford, Brendan Flynn of Wicklow Town, Jim Rees of Arklow, Kevin Lee of Carnew, and of course, our regular contributor, Horig Og O'Rourke. And listeners, just to let you know that the next head school will be looking at Kildare in the revolutionary decade. Of course, that has its own particular features. So listeners, hope to get you to tune in then. Thank you.